C4. Number 2B.
In order to explain the structural deduction from one principle, I have to perhaps tell you first what this implies. See, the old traditional view of scientific deduction on scientific research for scientific truth was to find statements with a maximum degree of probability. With the traditional view felt that if we could make a statement that would be 100% right, and if possible would cover a very large field of investigation, that this would be a terrific achievement, the achievement of a genius. Now today, the philosophy of today looks at it completely different. We have, for instance, the great philosopher in England, Popper, who is now regarded as one of the leading philosophers, who contests this old traditional view. And he really says that any fool can state such a truth statement with 100% validity, that it doesn't need a big thinker, that it doesn't need a genius, that it only needs a fool. And I was so impressed by that, because it began to show me really some parallel views that we were seeing in the line of religion in the general and of Christian Science, perhaps in a specific way. So Popper says that the traditional view, which tries to give a statement of greatest probability, say, which is true 100%, he says that such statements are not really practical because they usually have no informative value. They are like an empty shell. They really don't say anything that is of practical value. He's a philosopher that sees that only truth that is practical is really truth. So he sees principle and practice as one. He doesn't have a philosophy on a principle which is not practical. He feels that his philosophy must be a philosophy within wherein theory and practice are one, and therefore that the statement of truth must have maximal practical value. He says that that in the traditional view, the probability of those statements is impractical. For instance, he takes the example, you can state a terrific truth, it will rain, and that's truth, and nobody can disprove it. It has 100% validity. But its practical use is nil, because it doesn't say anything where it will rain, when it will rain, how much it will rain. So though this is a terrific big statement which cannot be disproved, therefore which has 100% validity, its information content is nil. It doesn't say anything. And any fool, he says, can make such big statements that are 100% right. So what he proposes is that we make statements that have great practical value, wherein the informative content is really maximal instead of minimal. But he says in order to give scientific statements which have a great information value, a great truth content, you have to fill this statement with other categories. You have to bring in, say, in the statement it will rain, you have to bring in a different category, which has nothing to do with rain, which has, say, to do with place. So you have to intertwine it will rain with a place. It will rain in Brandywine. Huh? or you intertwine it with time. Time has nothing to do with rain. But if you intertwine it, you say it will rain in Brandywine at 2 o'clock, for instance. So the more categories you bring in into your statement, the more there is truth content or there is information content in it. But naturally, the more categories you bring in, the more you will run the risk of miscalculating, of misstating. And so the validity may not be 100%. But he says it's still more practical than a statement without any truth content. Therefore, to sum it up, what we really want is a useful and relevant truth content in our statement. And therefore, great truth, as stated sometimes, we see that they have no real truth and practical value. Let me take, for instance, now Christian Science. The traditional view would say this is a terrific statement with 100% probability or 100% validity. If I make the statement as we have it in the textbook, as we have it in other religions, namely, God is all, or there is but one God, or God is the infinite one. These are terrific big statements, and any fool can make them. They are true because it's actually so. Actually, it's only a play of words. Instead of all, you say God. It's actually only a tautology, saying God is all, or you say to the all, that all I call God. It's as dumb as that, really. It's a tautology. Do you say tautology? Dennis, tautology? Yes. It's a tautology. You just exchange one word with another word, and explain one word through the other word which you have exchanged. Can you see? So here sometimes the Christian Scientists and all the other religious people are and say, oh, you know, God is all. You know, my dear, there is only one God, you know. And think they have stated a terrific truth. It's a statement of a fool. Of a fool. Any fool can do that. So it is a great truth. It's an irrefutable truth, and it has a maximum degree of validity. It's 100% valid, and what it is, its truth content, its information content, nil. It's nil, because it doesn't say anything about this all. On the contrary, it leaves all the wrong conclusions open. So we can ask, is this science when we say truth or God is all? Or when after a terrific argument between two people on metaphysics, a terrific argument, they just can't see eye to eye, somebody else comes in and says, but my dears, you know, it's all one. It's all one. After all, we are all discussing about the same thing. It's all one. This is the argument of a fool, not of a reconciliator, not of a scientist who can see through those arguments. So, such big statements, which are true and which appear over and over in the textbook, are true, but they alone don't constitute science. What constitutes science is the content of that statement, the investigation of that content. So we don't need to have just an empty shell, we have to fill that emptiness with something. We have to put into that shell what We have to put into that the truth content as science. There comes science in. God is all is not the statement of science. That's a statement of the one being. That which is inside, the structure inside that keeps that shell intact, that shows the relationship and the structure within that shell, that is science. So if we say God is one or God is all and leave it at that, then the reasoning is, all right, God is all. He is evil, he is good, he is matter, he is spirit, he is death, he is life, he is atom bombs, he is microbes, he is disease, he is joy, he is whatever you like. Huh? If it's all, then it's all. Therefore, such statements are very dangerous because they do not explain anything. They, therefore, are impractical. That's what Mrs. Eddy said in her last article on Principle and Practice, and says if you go on just by saying that God is all and God is good, that's just a question of belief, and you do not understand it, then you cannot practice it, and therefore the practice is equal nil. It's impractical. That's why the mystics want to be impractical. They don't want to be practical because they want to be up in the nirvana and want to be one with that undifferentiated whole, and therefore they want to sit on the top of the mountain, look up in the sky. They never want to come down like Jesus from the Mount of Vision and come down into the valley and heal the sick and deal with the practical problem of the day. They don't want to do that. They only have the ascending way of getting as quickly as possible into the nirvana and leave the world behind. Jesus said, I came from the Father, and I've come into the world. And now, though I'm not from the world, I'm in the world, and now I'm going to leave the world again and go to my Father. He came down and went up again. Meaning that we have to see that the statement that God is all, that there is one truth, is a very high statement, but let's fill it with what it implies right down, with what it implies right down to the human and to the proposition of evil, and resolve that proposition of evil and clear it up properly, and then we can say, now we can leave the illusion of evil and of the material world behind us, and now we can go into heaven without having a sense that there is something else beside God. So we see that we have to fill this great statement that God is all and one, and that there is only one God, with a content. But what kind of content? Shall we fill it with a heap of atomistic truths? With the omnigatherum of aphorisms, as I said, the textbook is? Or shall we fill it with system? System which demand for categories, system which demands that we know how to reduce the infinite phenomena to categories and combine categories in a system, that knows how to restructure the system in order to have structure. That's the way. So the great question comes up about categories. I am going to spend now some time on the question of categories, because we see, as I have said, that in our deductive reasoning from the one principle, we do not want to reason from the one principle to infinite atomistic truths, but to structure and system, therefore to categories. So let me talk a little bit about categories, because we say that structural thinking is categorical thinking. Don't misunderstand categorical with categorical. Categorical is from category, and categorical, whether seen it is something completely different. Categorical is imperative, is apodictical, is a demand, huh? Is a command. And the categorical imperative is from Kant, but that has nothing to do with the categorical consciousness. To form categories in consciousness and to think in categories instead of atomistic truths. This is the great step. You have seen that thinking in atomistic truths is a very burdensome undertaking, because there are infinite, millions, infinite, numberless atomistic truths in being. And therefore, to try to get hold of numberless truths is a burdensome, tiresome enterprise. But if we can put a lot of these atomistic ideas under a certain category, then we can simplify our reasoning very much. Then we may have just a few big categories in which all the infinite truths find their right place. Now, this is a philosophical method that has been seen right from the beginning of philosophy, right back with Plato and with Aristoteles. Aristoteles already, I think it must have been the first one, that tried to reduce all the infinite phenomena with which one has to deal with in being, tried to reduce all these infinite phenomena to 10 categories. So can you see his terrific contribution? He was the first one to think, why to think in numberless ideas? Why not to think in few categories in which all these numberless ideas are categorized, so as to simplify one's reasoning? Just as you have seen, you take the infinite ideas of God and you categorize them under ideas of mind and ideas of spirit and soul, principle, life, truth, and love, and so you categorize them just in 7 categories of the 7 synonymous terms, and that is much easier to handle spiritually than numberless ideas. So that was at the beginning, and Aristoteles hoped that he could bring back or reduce all these phenomena to 10 categories. It didn't work. And every big philosopher that came along tried to categorize according to different criteria. And so we have a whole history in philosophy on the way of how to categorize the numberless or infinite phenomena of existence. For instance, Kant, he tried to make 4 main categories. You see, Aristoteles had 10. He already tried to make 4 to reduce it even more. And so we have a whole history of how to categorize. I don't want to go into them. It's not necessary. The main thing is that we know the attempt that has been made. Now, before I go on, I just want first to read a few definitions from the Dictionary of Philosophy. Sorry, I had it only attend in German, so I had to translate it, and perhaps in English you would have much better definitions. Still, they give us a good insight into what is meant by categories. So here are a few excerpts from the dictionary. It says, every field of science has its own categories. So we can see that every science tries to find in their field their categories, like arithmetic tries to find other categories than perhaps physiology. Physiology would try to find completely different categories in order to systematize the whole field of physiology than naturally arithmetic would do. So we have the right in Christian science to have our own categories, and that we are still scientific if we try to have our own categories. It says further, only a few of them have everywhere the same function. saying, so to say, only a few of the categories in the various sciences overlap and have a common function. I just show you that because at the end we'll see what the categories of Christian science do. Further, it stated, not all the categories of being, now we come to the categories of being, not all the categories of being are represented in the human understanding. This is already quite a good indication that not all the categories of being are represented in human understanding. Else there would be nothing which would not be recognizable. Can you see where philosophy is? They feel that humanly we can never understand the divine, because they feel that the categories of being are not fully represented in the categories of the human. And therefore go out right from the beginning that the human will never understand the divine through their categories. It further says, it is analyzed how much, in a specific case, the categories of being are identical with the categories of understanding or consciousness, and in how far they differ. Can you see the philosophical approach? It is a dualistic approach which says there is a realm of divine being and there is a realm of human understanding, and they only overlap in a fraction, so to say. There are fields in each one which do not overlap, and therefore the categories of being are not represented in the categories of human understanding, and therefore they cannot understand each other completely. Further, they say the structures of the categories of being can only be guessed. Only guessed, not understood. Can you see how limited the categories of human thinking are? They can never understand the divine. And therefore, it is quite interesting to see how in modern times, I mean the last 20, 30 years, that whole philosophical approach has begun to change. I think Nicolaus Hartmann was one of the first one. He was a great ontologist and philosopher also in the 40s, 30s, 40s. And he began to see that we must have levels of categories. Not only categories that are on the same level, but we must have levels of different altitude. And he already began to indicate those four levels which we find in Christian science and which begin more and more to show that the categories of being can translate themselves to the categories of human understanding, and that there is a possibility that the human understanding can understand the divine. But he was a very progressive thinker. And in the same way, somehow, if you have read that wonderful book of Köstler, he was only the editor of the Alpnach Symposium round about 1969 or 70, where all the great thinkers of various fields of science came together and had as their idea they wanted to discuss that very thing, that we should no more think reductionally, but dimensionally, that we should not try to reduce and reduce and reduce and have only a reductive sense, but that we must think dimensionally, and that every phenomena appears again on a different level as a different form, but still remaining the same thing. See, they began to indicate what we see in the levels, namely that the level of science itself, though it is very different from, say, the level of Christian science, that still they are the same values, the same truth, but translated from the category, now we have the dimensional category, from the category of science itself, translated to the category of divine science, then translated to the category of absolute Christian science, then translated to the category of Christian science, and every time it is translated, it appears as a new phenomena, but still remaining the same. And in this way, the way was opened there, opened in the field of philosophy, that actually what I have been reading you out of the Dictionary of Philosophy is not relevant. That actually there must be a way how the divine and the human coincide, and how it is only a matter of seeing the categories rightly, the divine categories, seeing that they translate themselves to the human categories. That the human categories should not be something else, but the translated form of the divine categories. It's terrific. But then, at that very symposium, Bertha Landfi came and said, yes, all the categorization that we have had since Aristotle don't work and can't work, because they all go out from the human, instead that they go out from the divine. And so he stated that, therefore, the human system of reference can never understand the divine. That what is needed is that we have another system of reference than the human, that we have a divine system of reference.